Hey, this is Russell, and I work at the video store, the place that we can all go to every week when it's movie night. On days like today, when the store is quiet, I get to watch movies and series and talk about them with my friends that work here. All right, let's do it. Let's open up the shop. Did you see that thing yesterday on the TV? How's it, guys?
Morning, Russell.
Morning.
Hi, you, Graham.
Right, yourself.
It's nice to have you back, man. I've missed you.
Your parents have been doing this shift for a while.
Yeah, it's nice to have old Perrin, we need a little G-force in our life. And we got Cole here.
Hi.
How are you, Cole?
I was going to say variety is the spice of life.
Yeah. Sure, in some ways.
Yeah. You stick around and get to meet all the other people and all the other co-workers.
Yeah, no, it's nice to shake it all up. Hello, everyone. Thank you for wandering in to our video store today. Mm. And we're going to have ourselves a fat chat.
What are you all doing here?
Yeah. No, it's nice to see you, man. Just before we get started, I want to make a little staff announcement. I want to put it out on the loudspeaker so that everyone can hear it. I'm going to press this little button over here. Attention all customers, this is to let you know that our good friends over at Duis Wine are running a nice little promotion with us. If you go over to duis.wine, you can get 15% off your order, but you have to choose the pickup at the Bioscope. So we've been doing this for a while, where we're allowing people to pick up their wine at the Bioscope, especially if you live in Joburg, obviously, to save on shipping. So you can save on your shipping by choosing the Bioscope, but if you use the promo code VideoStoreDuis, you'll still love the fact that the name of this thing is Duis. Over at Duis.wine, you can get 15% off that order.
We had you guys, the two of you, come to the Bioscope on Friday night.
Yeah.
Yes.
Cole and Graham, and you guys came to watch a dumpling box edition of The Boy and the Heron.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, what did you think?
Nice to watch it again.
Definitely.
And notice things that I completely forgot about when I tried to figure it out last time I watched it.
Yeah, so The Boy and the Heron is the new Miyazaki. It came out at the end of last year, and it took South Africa a while to get the cinema rights. At one point, it actually looked like we were never going to have it come to cinemas.
You're involved in that chat now.
Yeah, it's very exciting. And a lot of people were waiting for it and asking me if we would ever screen it. And then the exciting news came that it was one of the smaller distributors in South Africa, Gravel Road, that can often, you know, when you're smaller, you can pick up these titles that if they sort of are going a bit rogue, they took the rights. And I knew instantly that this was going to be a Bioscope hit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not only is it just because it's this incredible award-winning animation studio from Japan, but the Bioscope hosts regular anime nights, these dumpling box nights, where we watch anime and we eat dumplings.
Nice.
And so I think we've become a place for this kind of content.
Yes.
And so it actually took us a few weeks before we actually now did a screening as a dumpling box night.
Right.
Because I think we got to make it a little special occasion, you know, every now
exactly.
and again. So They always sell out. Mm-hmm. Every dumpling box we've ever done has sold out. If they don't, we're doing something wrong, I think.
Yes.
But it's just one of those charming things that I think a very long time ago when we started the Bioscope, mm-hmm. so this is now, we probably started doing this within a year of opening. So
a
you're talking
long
like
time
sort
ago
of.
In 2011.
Yeah. 13, 14 years ago.
Right. 2011 would be your second year of operating.
We started in 2010.
Yeah.
We realized that just instinctively we knew that you have to invent cinema in many ways to make it interesting, especially the older stuff.
Yeah.
You know, you could put on, you know, In the Mood for Love and perhaps a few people would come. In the Mood for Love and Noodles.
Yes.
And it sells out.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
We sort of learned that quite early on that that is the point of the Bioscope, is to event cinema in some way. Do it on a certain day every year, or there's a tradition, like we just had Mother's Day, where everybody watched Stepmom, and their ticket included a pocket pack of tissues and an ice cream. Because, my God, that is a happy, ugly cry.
Stepmom.
Stepmom.
Never heard of it.
Julia Roberts and Susan Sarandon.
Okay.
Okay.
Oh, my God. Cancer.
Oh, no.
Split families.
Lord.
Oh, no. Jenna Malone in all her, like, teenage angst as the daughter. You're not my real mom.
Right. Oh, really?
Yeah, but it's heartwarming. So it's Chris Columbus.
Oh, I recognize the poster from the video store.
Yeah.
You know, when you'd browse for 2 hours before making a decision.
Lovely movie. And just the perfect movie to embody what it means to be a mother.
Right.
The basic back of the box of Stepmom is Julia Roberts is the new girlfriend that is now, like, having to look after the kids. And in the beginning, it's about a little bit of this competition between her being the young, new, hot girl that's, you know, taken the ex-husband's fancy,
right?
Who's quite professional, so she doesn't necessarily know how to be a mom. And then Susan Sarandon, who is the mom that they've grown up with, that they love and have a legacy with. But then halfway through the movie, it's revealed that the mom, Susan Sarandon, has cancer.
Right.
And so, you know, you've got to put the petty differences aside. You've got to work to sort of what the future.
Right.
The best way is there's this fucking haunting scene. Not haunting. Very mushy scene.
Memorable.
Memorable scene where basically Sarandon's like, I might have their past, but you have their future.
Oh, my God.
And everyone's just fucking crying. And
it's
you're
like
crying.
One of those lines.
Yeah.
One of my favorite critics, Zoe Rose Bryans, said, like, you know, Letterboxd has become about 1 to 2 liner witty reviews.
Interesting, because that's what I always said
exactly.
was going to be the future of reviewing. Yeah.
And this, you wanted to make a website around this.
Yeah,
you
wanted to have something called Three Lines.
Yeah.
ThreeLinesOn.com. I think I still own the URL.
But her review says, AKA Julia Roberts and Susan Sarandon stomping on my heart for 125 minutes.
Yeah, sounds about right.
So that's it.
But yeah, so that's
Happy Mother's Day is the one review.
No, it really is a happy cry. And I think that's an important one, is that it's...
We need happy cries.
It's heartwarming and it's, you know, but it's just what it means to be a mom is just explored throughout the whole thing. As right. Julia Roberts discovers it, as Susan Sarandon learns more about it herself.
Okay.
It's just, it's delightful. But yeah, that's the thing, is that we could just throw it on and you get popcorn. But, you know, it's fun to play with these ideas.
Yeah.
And I remember once being at a bar talking to friends or something, and we were saying, oh, what's your ugly cry film? And everyone said, you know, the one that they've sort of cried the most about. And then I said, we could have a night at the Bioscope. Ugly cry night.
No ways.
And then you start it.
Yes.
Which is lovely. And I love that ability to sort of move quickly.
Yes.
And I think that's the charm, and I think that's the point of a place like the Bioscope, is to go quickly.
But also, you weren't a part, like, you're a part of the modern distribution, like, system now.
Yeah.
As a cinema, but you weren't in the beginning. Mm. You had to do something to make yourself, you know, appealing and get people to go out to Maboneng.
Right.
You know, it's a
come
to your cinema.
Yeah, that repertory cinema, which is the term. You know,
really?
To play older titles.
Okay.
Right.
I didn't know that.
Was something always from the plan. It was always from the get-go was to be that. Because you just have this infinite amount of cinema available to you. You know, that can come out at all points. I mean, this morning I woke up to find out Roger Corman has passed away.
Oh, this producer.
Famous filmmaker of B grade stuff, who got so many Hollywood people started. Jack Nicholson and all these people, all these filmmakers, Coppola, all of them started in Roger Corman's sort of B movie system.
Mm.
He died at 98.
Yep. Sure.
Yeah. So, like, now would be a great chance to pull out some of those films. They're all, like, bad, but we've got a avenue for that. We call it cheesy movie night.
Yeah,
right.
Where it's all you can eat pizza for the duration of the movie, and we can watch Attack of the Crab Monsters. Like, I would watch that.
Yeah, totally.
Try and track down his Fantastic Four movie.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Great. Still a wall of knowledge.
Well, please try.
Yeah.
It never officially got released.
Oh, then it might be
harder. Little Shop of Horrors.
Yeah, Little Shop of Horrors with Jack Nicholson, the original. Yeah, there's a lot out
with
there.
With Jack Nicholson.
Yes. With Jack Nicholson.
We spoke about this before on the show.
Graham.
What is a movie they made in, 3 days or something?
Yeah, I don't know.
What?
Yeah. No, very interesting. So we can do that. So we very early on, now just to take it back to Dumpling Box,
yes,
which is what you guys came for on Friday night. We're going to do it again this coming Friday, by the way.
Nice.
In the week that this episode is coming out. Tickets available at thebioscope.co.za.
Oh, come on, Russ.
Link in the description.
We wanted an avenue for Asian cinema. We wanted to event around that. Mm-hmm. And we thought, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, like the sort of beautiful kung fu movies. That yes. was kind of something yes. that we were thinking about in 2010. And we thought, and noodles. And so it was called right. Noodle Box Cinema.
It's awesome.
And that's how we got started.
I remember that's, I went to come watch Ghost in the Shell for the first time.
Okay, as a noodle
brother.
Box.
Yeah, it's like an excuse to go out with my brother. I was like, we both love anime. This sounds great.
Yeah, so we just did all sorts. I remember doing The Host, which was the Bong Joon-ho
yes.
film. And then we did more classic stuff, as I said, like In the Mood for Love. But we also did like, the Crouching Tiger stuff and then the sort of more, I don't know, lesser known but cool kung fu stuff.
Yes.
In the Mood for Love is great for that because it orientates itself around noodles quite a bit.
Yeah, they
always go downstairs to buy noodles at that place.
And then we struggled to find people who could do it because you needed it to be ready in these portions.
Right.
And they needed,
needed to be hot.
The old Bioscope was 60 seats. So right. that's quite a lot of boxes of noodles to get ready. So it's quite a big gig. And at one point, there was a business in Mabuning called the Blackanese, which we really wanted to support, which was this black-owned business making Asian food.
Awesome.
And the owner was a really cool guy, but he couldn't do it. Like, he just couldn't get it ready in time. And, they were busy cooking away. And as the boxes were ready, we were taking them in. And, it was like, it wasn't working. But Daryl then, this is the guy I started the Bioscope with for the first 5 years. Daryl was in the business. He went to Cyril Dean once and said, I found a place. The food's great. And we used them for ages. And the daughter of this family, the one who could speak the most English, was a woman called Daisy.
Okay.
And we loved Daisy.
Yeah.
It was so easy to just phone Daisy. Be like, Daisy, we're going to do it on Friday. Cool.
Oh, right. One of those.
Eight
I got
beef,
you.
20 this, how many chickens?
Yeah.
The variations.
The different orders, because you'd place that with your ticket order.
And she says, okay, ready by 7:30. Okay, bye,
legend.
Bye, done. Then Daisy's family weren't there anymore. They moved, and we couldn't find anyone to do the noodles.
Right.
And then we actually put it on ice for the longest time until Daisy was like, hello, I've started a dumpling house. Daisy Dumplings House.
Oh, cool. Nice.
And it's so funny because it should be Daisy's Dumpling House.
Yes.
I was about
but
to say.
But instead it's Daisy Dumplings House. Like her name is Daisy Dumpling, which I guess is maybe fine.
Yeah.
So it's her house. And it's in Rivonia, which is kind of like the new Chinatown. I don't know whether you've spent enough time in Rivonia to realize this.
No.
So Cyril Dean is like our Chinatown,
yes.
which is formalized by those big gates,
yes.
which they've since built, which is cool. Deep in Chinatown, deep in Cyril Dean, those folks can't speak English. Eh?
Yeah.
And there was one or two times where I was trying to talk to people, and I was even Google translating cinema. And they didn't know what I was talking about. And I was like, this is not going to work.
Yeah.
If you don't even know what a cinema is, how are you going to have however many boxes ready by this time? But then when Daisy announced that she started this dumpling house, I was like, easy. Dumpling box cinema now.
Dumpling box.
Easy.
Nice dumplings.
Daisy is actually, unfortunately, now no longer in the business. And her family have gone away again. I think they've gone back to China. But the people who took it over are still making these dumplings
right.
as well as Daisy did. And so, so that's where your dumplings came from.
Okay.
It's in Rivonia and it's called Daisy Dumplings House.
Also, that's no drive to scoff at. Like if you think about
it's not
order,
too bad. Yeah.
Getting it ready and then bringing it from Rivonia to the Bioscope on time. That's
logistically,
that's a lot.
Yeah. So we time it. We give ourselves half an hour.
Okay,
and we like just make it within minutes, but it's cool because then it means that they're as fresh and as hot as we can,
as you can manage.
Yeah. But I remember once, just one one of these memories, especially when it was like a chow mein-y noodle.
Yeah,
so back in the noodle box days, I remember getting all the way to the Bioscope and in Mabuning, and there were these little side streets, you know, where someone would come out of a parking lot.
Yes.
And like 10 meters away from the Bioscope, this car like jutted out and I braked suddenly. And about 10 noodle boxes just like... splotched into like the front of my dashboard.
No.
And I was like, fuck, man. And as I arrived, I was like, okay, we need to pick 5 or 6 people and they're going to get pizzas. I'm sorry.
Sorry, guys. This is what I need to do.
I'm going to spend the next 10, 15 minutes like cleaning the shit out of my car. But yeah. But it's fun. And I think that's what the charm of the Bioscope can be, sort of create an experience around cinema that just amplifies the cinema, and especially Ghibli. So the studio behind The Boy and the Heron have famously always made their food look so good in all their movies. And so like to be able to eat something that is just in the realm of Asian. Yes. Like I know it's not an actual Japanese dumpling.
Yeah.
Who cares? Yes. Like, it's still a lovely dumpling that is from that part of the world.
Yeah.
It's more of a Chinese dumpling, but it's lovely. And so, The Boy and the Heron, which is now in cinemas, and I think going to just keep screening at the Bioscope for as long as we can, is a very complicated and quite nuanced film. Yeah. And when we watched it for the first time now, a couple of weeks ago, we all said we should... given another watch.
Yeah.
Just because of how nuanced it is.
Yes.
If you've watched any Miyazaki or any Studio Ghibli, you know it's deeply layered. It's very complex to the point where it's like not really for kids.
Yeah.
It's an age limit of 7 to 9, I think. Is the age limit. But it's kind of creepy, kind of weird.
Yes.
There's like a sort of like little Mediterranean man living inside the body of a heron. No, he speaks Japanese, but he kind of looks a little Greek with a big nose.
That's racist. No, I'm joking.
He sort of slowly crawls out of this heron throughout the movie.
I remember when I remember saying this. Russ is so funny to watch movies with that are weird.
Yeah.
Because as soon as his teeth and his nose start to come out the side of the heron's beaks, just here Russell goes, "What the fuck, man?
are those teeth? Why are there teeth? I can see an eyeball.
What the fuck?"
No, bro? So it's wild and it's wildly different. And it's the kind of thing that, you know, I think we said this at the start when we had a more focused Boy and the Heron episode, that it's not Pixar. And it comes from a land that is very different, with imagination that is very different, and thought that's very different.
Yes.
They're
fully peeking into a different culture.
Yeah,
and it's just, you know, the Japanese have just been so remarkably different from the rest of the world.
Yeah.
For many reasons. One of the biggest being the fact that they isolated themselves and they for 2 centuries didn't allow any foreigner to set foot on Japanese soil. When the rest of the world was trading and colonizing and, you know, mixing and matching and creating all sorts of interesting ethnicities, the Japanese just didn't want anything to do with it.
Yeah.
And even my friend, funny enough, who lives in Japan, who's half South African, half Japanese, so she could give us great insight and subtlety.
Oh, cool.
Right.
Whenever we toured Japan as a band, they, after COVID, stayed locked down for considerably longer than the rest of the world.
Right.
Right.
There were a couple of those countries that used it.
Yes.
To the point where like it was a bit silly. They used it as something else.
Right.
And Japan used it as a way to just flex their own control and to not actually allow others in.
Interesting.
When the rest of the world was getting back to business.
Right.
That was her feeling.
Oh, okay.
Was like they like them, they don't like foreigners, and so they used this as a chance just to keep it for a little bit longer.
Yeah, it was also very interesting teaching English, and I had a student that I speak to at 8 a.m. every morning, and
because, a Japanese student,
like very interesting character as well, business consultant that moved away from her husband's place outside of Tokyo to go live in Tokyo to do business in Tokyo.
Right.
And would go back home like every 2 to 3 months to see her husband and stuff.
Interesting.
So it's like it's a completely different life. And her husband was, I think, playing a professional rugby player in Japan, which is weird.
Yeah, no, like, they
uncommon.
They're pushing that a lot now.
Oh, really? Are they pushing
that? Yeah, no, and that Japanese like tenacity and ferocity.
Yes.
And sort of they, you know, they were relentless.
Yes.
You know, in World War II, they were yeah. relentless. They yeah. did not fucking give up.
Yeah. yeah.
They put their Absolutely. Bodies on the line. They were kamikaze pilots. Yeah. So like that sensibility in rugby
yes.
makes sense.
Oh, absolutely.
Do you know
does.
What I mean? Like sumo, yeah. sumo wrestlers.
Yes, yeah. that's it. It's the same thing.
The act of sumo wrestling is very similar to scrumming and rucking. So like it makes sense that they would be good rugby players. Yeah. They just need to be bigger.
Exactly, yeah.
Interesting.
But because we spoke so much, we become like quite candid and yes. relaxed, and we became super friendly because it was like 2 years of talking to her every morning at 8 a.m.
It's interesting, these people that you've come to know.
No, it's amazing, dude. Yeah. Like really amazing people. But she would tell me that, yeah, like she would say a lot of people are really fake in Japan.
Right.
Like they'll be polite and they'll say hi, but then they'll walk away and kind of resent you for speaking Japanese if you're a person that's learning Japanese,
right.
or if you're yeah. an outsider like that.
There's two things I want to share. The one was, whenever you see a foreigner in Japan, like at a train station, you spot them on the other side, like you both lock eyes,
right?
Because I've done this many times.
Oh yeah,
you lock eyes and both of you think the exact same thing, which is like, why are you here?
Why? What's the deal?
What are you doing here?
What are you?
It's like you and I look very different, and we sort of like lock eyes.
I don't know, because you've told us that story before, but I don't know if I've told you this story before. My friend taught English in Japan for the longest time, and she, didn't make. A lot, obviously, like when you start, you don't have a lot of friends. You just have like the teachers at the school,
yeah.
and this little old lady, like you know, the little old ladies in Boy and the Heron,
yeah,
that are all bent over. And they're yeah. like, I saw a meme once that was like beautiful Japanese lady,
yeah,
and then
yeah.
the moment she turns 60 or something, it's like
turns just this a little old lady, over. Yeah, yeah.
And she invited her over for tea,
oh yes,
and said like, come have tea every Saturday with me. So that she had someone to talk to,
right.
which is like so fucking sweet. She was walking in the street and a whole bunch of little boys ran up to her, like very like naughty, mischievous look in their faces
yes.
and shouted, "Gaijin!" and ran away. Like he ran off into the distance because like...
What
like,
does that mean?
Gaijin means foreigner. So it's a word that can just mean that casually, but it also can be used as a slang word. Yes. Not a slang word,
yeah, like derogatory.
Derogatory word. Yeah.
But that's what's mind-blowing is that who gives a shit in any other country?
No, exactly.
It's like if you're used to them, this is also, once again, about representation.
Yes.
If you've seen lots of other foreigners, who gives a shit?
Exactly. Suddenly become used to.
It just shows you that these little boys haven't seen a lot of foreigners.
Yeah, exactly. It's
so
like
that's why that's
them.
A thing, and that's why that's a word.
Yeah.
But I'll never forget taking a Kalula flight. It's important that I say Kalula because they wear they're not around anymore, but they had those obnoxiously big collars. Do you remember the male staff had to wear those like quite fabulous, they almost ridiculous collars.
Yeah.
Like, okay. Anyways, but this young, you know, well-meaning chap who was the flight attendant on this Kalula flight to Asian folk said, "Sheshe," you know, just thank you.
Yeah.
I just straight up saw an Asian person in a wind.
Yeah,
session.
And sort of, you know.
Like well-meaning.
It's well-meaning, yeah. you know. And this Japanese guy stopped him to say, "Sheshe is Japanese. I mean,
it's
Chinese.
Chinese yeah.
I am Japanese. We don't say sheshe."
Mm.
And this guy said, "Okay, cool, thanks." He went on to say the same point three or four times. Right. He wanted to make damn sure this guy didn't.
You can't
think
just go
was
to
Chinese.
An Asian person yes. and assume that they all speak Chinese.
Oh, but, you know, I think other nations would have gone, "Hey, you know, we don't say sheshe. I'm Japanese. We say arigato."
Yes.
Just now you know.
Yeah.
But he wanted to make damn sure this guy didn't think he was Chinese.
Oh, really? Oh, that's
the
reason.
It was an imperialist thing.
Yes.
Which is very
that
interesting.
That makes sense.
So, anyways.
Anyways, I want to
anyway,
know.
This is a movie podcast.
Yeah.
What were your thoughts on the second watch, Graham?
Ooh, that's a good question. I think one of my big things that, like, dawned on me, like you were saying, it's kind of hard to get into because of different cultural reasons, that sort of thing. I think another thing about this film is it is entirely not for us.
Sure.
It is a movie made by Hayao Miyazaki for no one but Hayao Miyazaki.
Cool.
It's entirely his film.
Okay,
so sure. It's not a movie for audiences.
That's very interesting.
Like he wanted to do something. He obviously had this thing that he needed to get out.
This like creative
and
worm
like,
in his brain.
It doesn't matter how much he alienates the audience, anything like that. He's just like, this is, I'm putting this on
yes.
on the screen.
Yes.
So I think it's important to then mention we are talking about an 80-odd-year-old man.
Yeah, he's in his 80s.
Who has very famously retired, comes out...
Multiple times.
Comes out, makes a movie, wins at Cannes. Yes. I'm retiring. Disappears. Comes out, makes a movie, wins the Academy Award. Yes. So The Boy and the Heron won Best Animated Feature at this year's Oscars.
Yeah.
Yes.
So that's the other important thing to mention when you talk about Miyazaki, when you talk about Studio Ghibli, which is the studio that makes these films, is that they're making art.
Yes.
It's not a pulp content kind of TV show, which a lot of anime is, where it's very serialized. Mm. It can be quite crazy and ridiculous or gory.
Yeah, the anime industry is so huge. There is so much of it.
And they pump a lot out for a tiny little island nation. Yeah. So it's like there's a lot that gets made. So then it's very interesting that when he then decides I'm going to make a movie, he makes this incredibly complex, nuanced...
And it takes like 7 years.
Very indulgent, as you said, very personal film.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you just realized this was not made for you. You were just
definitely.
You were just allowed to
watch it. Looking at someone's expression.
Like, think about our first reactions when we watched it. You kind of sit there and go, "Wait, where are we? What?
Yes.
What's happening?
Yeah.
What is this?
Exactly. Which I think is a big part of the reason why there's so many different readings of it. It's so easy to interpret things differently because he's not giving you the interpretation.
Absolutely. And I think that it was one of those films where. You know something, but then you forget about it, or you just have a moment where you realize it again.
Like
you have that moment, that eureka moment. And was with this where I was like, actually, it doesn't matter what he intended for this to be, it's how I read it.
Exactly.
It always, right? It always will be that.
Yeah. It's like Graham and I always had a thing with Close Encounters, where I was saying that Close Encounters was about... a father destroying the home.
Yeah, initially...
And it was about the divorce.
You initially said it was about divorce. I think later you've subsequently said, no, it's about a midlife crisis.
Okay, yes.
Which I do agree with, but I realize that when we had this debate, we're talking two totally different things.
Yes.
In terms of... So there's a quote from Steven Spielberg where he says, Close Encounters is a movie about children opening doors that adults are too afraid to.
Wow.
And that was my takeaway from this film.
Yes.
And that's theme.
Yes.
Whereas you're talking metaphor.
Okay, yes.
So we're talking about two totally different things that aren't in contrast to each other.
Yes.
No reason to disagree about them.
Exactly.
It can be about all of that.
Yes.
Yeah.
But what it is definitely about a midlife crisis. I think that's very intentional.
Yes.
Yeah.
Close Encounters.
Yes, of the third kind.
Which is a film I still need to see. We've spoken about
this. Didn't you come to the IMAX re-release?
No, we saw E.T. on IMAX.
Oh, E.T. and Jaws.
Yes.
Okay, sorry.
Yeah, I was about to say, there wasn't that on
screen. Screen it here sometime, bro.
Yeah.
Now you've got a cinema.
Yeah.
And you sell the poster. Don't you sell the poster, yeah?
No.
I was asking about the poster. I was saying I want one, and Russell says that the suppliers don't have.
It's safe to say it's one of the lesser remembered Spielberg films.
In some ways, it's not as big as a Jurassic Park
and Jaws.
Yeah,
E.T.
If we're talking about general audiences, they're not going to remember Close Encounters or Empire of the Sun. You know,
it's one of the smaller ones,
yes,
or lesser remembered. But you guys really love it, and I really want to screen it just watch it as a result.
Yeah.
I've seen the vinyl every now and again of the soundtrack.
Oh,
and
cool!
I've sold that once or twice.
Well,
soundtrack.
How about when there's time at the Bioscope? Because you're a lot busy. You're very busy these days because you have real screenings.
Yeah.
But why don't we do Video Store Presents nights?
Yeah, why don't we
where each clerk picks a movie?
Yeah. No, exactly.
I pick Close Encounters.
Okay. Cool. Then are you going to come and introduce it?
Sure.
Graham does a little speech. I love to see Graham's speech. Miss your speeches. We used to do speeches all the time together.
Oh,
in university.
Presentations and whatnot. Yeah.
Are you okay with public speaking?
Yeah.
I mean, this is technically public speaking.
But in a way.
The audience isn't quite in front of you, staring at you. Yeah, I must say, I've gotten okay with it. It's amazing how that's a muscle you have to get used to.
Yes.
And just from introducing things at the Bioscope, you get used to crowds of 60, regularly. And then, of course, with the band, it started with crowds of 2 and 4 and 10. And then before you know it, you're talking in front of 15,000, 17,000 people.
Yeah.
And you think that you wouldn't be able to do it, but you've warmed up to it.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So I must say, I am okay with speaking in front of people.
I realized when I did the Old Boy introduction.
As you got up, you were like, oh, shit.
I've forgotten how to do this.
Yes.
I was like, could pitch a film. I remember feeling this when we presented our film at Cinema One at Rosebank, Nevada. Yes. We were talking about this because that's where we went to go watch Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes.
Oh, what, now this weekend?
Yeah.
Okay, we'll talk about it. Yeah. Carry on.
I remember sitting there after the screening and getting all the audience questions.
Yes.
And seeing like the black and sea, and then we were told this is like our graduation presentation, so it's a big deal in terms of our marks, and there are a whole bunch of critics in the audience, etc., and they're asking you about the movie.
Yeah.
And I sat there going, I'm not nervous.
Yes. Brrr, well, I mean, we've been doing it.
And then you do it for that long, right?
We've been doing every couple of months for like 4 years, you know.
Yeah. And then you'd always pitch to all the people in your year.
Yes.
Like in first year, which was like 200 people.
No, it's a muscle. It's a muscle you have to work.
Also, I've pitched in like boardrooms across the country. I've spoken to like CEOs of big ad agencies and like boardroom presentations and everything. Yeah. And then I don't do it during COVID for like 4 years.
And then all of a sudden.
And then I get up in front of a cinema and I'm like, oh my God, I can't do this. Also, I've just done key change. So I've been performing in front of theaters of 400 people. Six times
different.
A week.
You were playing, you were speaking through
your
bass.
Exactly, it's like a completely different. Speaking through my bass.
Yeah. Yeah, speaking through your instrument. A lot of people are like, I can be a frontman holding a guitar, which is different to being a frontman who just sings.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, if you've got one little thing behind you, you can feel more.
It's like
confident.
Watching Elton John when he doesn't play the piano and sing. At his farewell concert on Disney Plus, you watch him sing the Dua Lipa remix with Dua Peep.
Yeah.
It's he shouldn't do that. You can see with his hands, he just
I can't even
know what
picture Elton John
without
like
a
standing
piano.
Yes, like he just has a piano in front of him at all times.
Yeah.
What was Planet of the Apes like?
Yeah, so this is the fourth Planet of the Apes film in this new run since the James Franco movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was about to say. So this Planet of the Apes is connected to the last three.
Yeah.
And can you, off the top of your head, give me the names of the three in the order?
Rise of the Planet of the Apes, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, War for the Planet of the Apes.
And it's War 4.
Yes.
Well done. I would not have
Rise?
Right. Rise, Dawn, War.
War 4.
Yes.
And this is now?
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes.
Okay, so this is us. This is the four-film story of how the Planet of the Apes came to be. Because one of the first ones we ever got given as a film society was the Charlton Heston Planet of the Apes.
Yes.
Which was a long time ago. Maybe we can get a date on that.
Yeah, I'm looking it up right now.
Where the planet had been created. They sort of they found themselves on a planet.
Yes.
Okay. What were they? Travelers? Space travelers?
They're in space, and a weird thing happens, and then they crash land on a planet.
Oh, is that how it starts?
Yes.
Oh, cool.
But then there's the very famous reveal at the end.
You blew it up.
Yeah.
You blew it all up. Damn you all to hell. Where it's real that he's been on Earth the whole time.
Okay.
They didn't know they were on Earth.
Yes.
But the planet was ruled by apes. And right at the end, he's on the beach, and you see the sort of Statue of Liberty.
Oh, like in the sand.
Fallen on the sand.
Iconic image.
It's a famous image, and that's when he realized he was on Earth. Then there was a Tim Burton version.
Well, there were a bunch of sequels to the Charlton Heston one first.
Okay.
Yeah, true.
Three or four sequels to that, which is where the weird naming convention comes from, because those ones were like Conquest of the Planet of the Apes and Beneath the Planet of the Apes and all that sort of thing.
But what was it for? Was it for, when it was this movie? Was that its first version, or was it a book, or was it a comic?
There's an original writer listed, so I think it was originally based on a book.
Okay. Then there was a Mark Wahlberg version.
Yes.
Where Tim Roth was the bad guy.
Yes.
Tim Roth.
Just talking about.
Yeah. Oh, I must tell you about Tim Roth.
Yeah.
Tim Roth and Michael Clark Duncan.
Yes, Michael Clark Duncan.
And Paul Giamatti.
Yes, as the orangutan.
As the orangutan, yeah.
But my God.
Was that any good?
I remember, look, I was like.
No, it wasn't. Yeah.
Well, listen.
It was terrible.
I was like, how old?
Yes, I was a kid when I saw it, and I was like, whoa.
Yeah, I was like, fucking
like,
wow,
these monkeys can have meetings.
I absolutely loved that movie.
When did that one come out?
2001, I believe.
Yeah, I was 10.
Yes.
Okay. I loved that shit.
Yeah. Okay, you loved it, Graham, you didn't like it.
I liked it at the time.
Yeah.
Okay.
But then I rewatched it last year with my movie
every day.
It's terrible.
Okay. Mark Wahlberg was the Charlton Heston character, right? Who sort of found himself on this.
That's right.
Yeah.
Was there the same reveal? Was it the same?
There is a same, like, similar reveal.
Well, there's a similar reveal. Yeah. Where he leaves the planet at the end in this one.
Okay. And then goes back to
Goes back through, like, the portal thing that brought him there. Crash lands on Earth, but the Earth is now monkeys for some reason. It's never explained.
It's not explained. He goes up to the Abraham Lincoln statue in Washington.
Yes. And it's a monkey instead of Abraham Lincoln.
Why are you laughing so much?
Yeah.
So funny.
It is a weird thing, yeah.
Just like, that's not Abraham Lincoln. It's Abraham Lincoln.
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, it's so funny. All right.
No, okay, I remember that. And then someone was like, let's do Planet of the Apes properly, which might take us 4 movies. And so the first version, which
very
was
much a prequel,
which was Rise.
Rise. Planet of the
Apes. That was with
James Franco,
and he was experimenting and somehow gave the monkey more brain.
It's the exact same plot as Deep Blue Sea, where they're trying to cure Alzheimer's by experimenting on animals, and they accidentally make smart animals.
Yes.
It's exactly the same story.
Well done, Graham. Fucking well done. Same plot.
And yeah.
Except Stellan Skarsgård doesn't get fucked up in Rise of the Planet of the Apes. Holy shit.
Samuel L. Jackson gets charged.
Yeah, he does in his speech. We are not gonna remember that. Everyone will talk about that.
Yeah. Okay, so then, Caesar the ape grows up, goes out.
Played by Andy Serkis.
Yeah, and then starts this whole story.
Yes. Mm,
okay, and so now we're quite far into the future.
Yeah, so basically Dawn is where you see him settle and create this new life and still trying to work with exigent humans that are trying to make, trying to get electricity again, for example. Then war is very much the military of people trying to come back and take over. Yeah. And
because, okay, so the thing that makes the apes intelligent is a virus.
Yes.
And it basically wipes out most of humanity.
I was about to say, how do they win? Because you would think that despite apes all of a sudden getting quite smart, humanity with all their tanks and guns would fuck them up.
But the end of the first movie is a virus spreading all over the world. That virus is the thing that made the apes intelligent. But it kills humans.
It's killing the humans. Yeah. Okay, so that's why that is. Okay. And
it's COVID times 1,000.
Yeah.
Okay. And so you guys have been here for all of this, and now this final version is
Kingdom.
Is Kingdom.
Yes.
Where there's majoritively apes, and then the few humans that are left, they're sort of hunting them, right?
Yes. So
What's the back of the box of Kingdom?
So back of the box of Kingdom, and I don't remember the trailer, so I'm going to try make an abridged summary that doesn't give away the plot. Is basically there is an ape who has a tribe, and then this tribe is invaded by another conquesting tribe of apes and kills his father, takes his family away as slaves. So he follows these people and discovers a leader that's bent on some nefarious goal.
Yes.
Okay. And then along the way, picks up a human straggler who's mute.
Okay.
Because the virus, in all the time that's passed, because it ends with Caesar dying, or it starts with Caesar dying, which happened at the end of War for the Planet of the Apes.
Yeah.
It's got a very Moses ending where he leads his ape clan to Canaan, but can't enter and dies.
Yeah.
It's very similar. But now Caesar's dead, and it says many generations later, and all the cities are overgrown.
Mm.
And you can get a sense that this is 50 to 100 years in the future.
I think it's quite a lot more than that. I think it's supposed to be 200 years later.
Really?
Or something,
And then they say that the virus had another effect, which made the inverse effects on humans that it had on apes. It actually dumbed humans down.
Because the apes are talking at this point.
Oh, yeah. So the apes are fully fluent. They're not doing
they're speaking English.
Yeah.
Yeah, because in the last, I mean, that's something that comes up in the last movie. Yes.
Of all the languages.
We're only in America.
If Caesar's the first one and he speaks English,
he teaches them.
Yes. Yeah. But that's the plot of the third one is where people get infected with this virus.
Oh, yes. And then they become dumb.
Yeah, that's what.
So it happens to
Woody Harrelson's character is executing people who are becoming infected and that sort of thing.
Right.
Okay.
Yes.
Very good movies.
I was about to say, what do we enjoy the most about?
These films are the best blockbuster studio franchise of the 2010s.
Mm.
I think they are incredible movies.
They are fucking great movies.
And why?
Because they understand that with movies about apes, I think it is on a superficial level, action movie that's for kids like us when we were watching the first Tim Burton Planet of the Apes. Yes. It's about the novelty of seeing apes.
Yes.
You know? And like apes with guns. Apes with guns.
Yeah.
Okay.
But then it's also got this incredible, well-written script, like yeah. through all of it.
Okay. So where they're smart movies.
They're smart movies. Well, yeah. They're well-made.
Yes.
They're well-told movies with beautiful stories that are about like family and protecting family and starting your own life. And trying to protect that family against the world.
Yes.
You know, and an existential threat. It's like, and it's cool to see that plot like framed against simians.
A big part of why those first three films work is they have a really well-written, well-performed, very compelling central character.
Oh, yes.
Caesar. Like,
which was Caesar.
Character.
Caesar was the main monkey.
Yeah.
Yeah, the main Andy monkey, Serkis. Andy Serkis.
Yeah.
And so Andy Serkis, who did... You know, who's really crafted the most incredible career for himself as the actor that does the motion captures.
Yes.
So he was Gollum in Lord of the Rings.
He was King Kong.
He was King Kong. So he's been an actor who's acted as himself.
Yes.
In a few roles,
famously in the Avengers. The South African guy without the arm.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
He was great in those movies.
He was
so
great.
Much fun. And it was just announced that he's going to be directing a new
Middle-earth.
Yeah. The Hunt for Gollum.
Yeah. And so
he's coming back to direct and perform.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so it's just interesting that he's just very good at this technology.
Yes.
Which I'm sure over all the movies that he's been motion captured for, I'm sure he's also seen just how remarkably better they just keep getting.
Yes. I saw
he's
an Instagram.
Particularly good at being this kind of actor.
Yes, the Academy released a on-set versus final product comparison of War for the Planet of the Apes.
Oh, okay,
who's the comedic actor from that played the ape that they found in War for the Planet of the Apes?
Is it Billy? No, it's
Steve
not Billy
Zahn.
Zane. Steve Zahn. Yeah,
yeah, Steve Zahn. And he's busy performing this little sensitive, sad monologue.
Mm.
And you can see when you're tracking it, especially with that vertical format on Instagram, it's really easy to see top and bottom.
Mm. Yeah.
And you can see exactly the dots in his face tracking exactly what the ape's doing. Yeah. So like this performance you're watching...
Is him.
Is the actor.
Yeah.
It's like it's become that. Where with Gollum, they didn't have facial tracking. I think Avatar was the first film to do that, right?
I don't know about the first, but it was definitely one of the ones that like pushed it forward a long way.
Because if you watch the making of Lord of the Rings, The Two Towers, the animators will talk about having Andy Serkis's on-set footage alongside and then like all the models they made for Gollum with different expressions and having to like old school Pixar style animate frame by frame Gollum's facial expression.
Yeah, Andy Serkis is basically a reference.
Yes.
So and then they would motion capture stuff afterwards, like in a studio to get like his motion and that sort of thing. But they weren't doing performance capture stuff yet.
But do you think that actor would ever be considered to be the actor? Like would you be able to win an award for acting if you were motion captured?
I think so.
Like, are we at that point now where you could be a nominated actor and it's...
I'd like to think of it as... Because we're at the point where it replicates so much. And I think you'd have to go into a process of understanding how much it was manipulated afterwards. Like if there was any tampering.
There has to be definitely. I think there's more tampering than we realize.
Right.
Like there's more of an animator as an intermediate there. They like to sell it as like, oh, we're like copying this like exactly. And then it kind of like.
It's like authentic.
It just, we just like copy and paste those points onto like the character. But if you think about a monkey's face and a human's face, those things don't exactly line up. Or you think about Josh Brolin and Thanos. Like, their faces don't actually really line up.
No.
So that, like, motion capture data isn't going to go one-to-one with that 3D model.
It's like
so an animator's going to have to go in there and make it, like, work.
My favorite is watching Benedict Cumberbatch's Smaug.
Yes.
Yeah, because he really sort of acted as this dragon.
Yeah, he was like, I'm a serpent.
And you're sort
of going,
take
like, this very seriously.
Do they use this at all?
No, I was like, fuck off, they don't use that.
Yeah. Interesting. Speaking of Tim Roth...
Oh, yes.
You mentioned Tim Roth about 20 minutes ago.
Yeah.
We are really enjoying a very easy to watch TV show on Disney Plus called Lie to Me.
Right.
Okay, I've seen that. What is that about?
It is the classic, easy crime, episodic TV show.
Like CSI? You know,
CSI vibes.
Oh, dude.
So it's very easy to digest. But the main little unique spin on it is this guy, played by Tim Roth, has got a particular company that helps solve crimes because they can detect if you're lying or not.
Right.
So it's not a a polygraph, but it's understanding and using science and biology to tell if someone's lying.
Right.
Certain things you do, certain facial expressions, how you twitch your shoulder or how you smirk your face, how you, you know, frown your brow, what indicates whether you're lying or not. And he's studied this and has turned it into an agency that helps.
Right.
So each episode is, you know, delightfully different from the next. Charming characters, kooky, and very lovable. But the one thing that's particularly good about this show, and apart from it just being a nice, easy watch that's not completely stupid, is that when they point out a certain thing,
yeah,
you know, this particular look means that you're disgusted. It means that you're actually not, for example, you don't want to do this. It means that the person doesn't want that, or
yes,
or is thinking this, or is actually holding contempt, saying one thing but meaning the other.
Sure.
The show will take public footage from like news and current stuff and just give you just two or three little stills of famous people doing the same expression.
Right.
And so you realize like, oh, fuck. You know, that's what Obama was thinking. Or like, if you're lying, you know, maybe stroke your face in a particular way. Or the way you repeat a sentence. You repeat the question and the answer. You know, certain things. And it would cut to like Bill Clinton going, I didn't have sexual relations with that woman. And you notice that he sort of flicks his nose in a particular way.
Or right.
Does this inflection that they've just spoken about. So all of a sudden, you start making sense of your own world and this reality through the show. It's a smart little, okay. It's just the little cherry on top.
Yes.
You know,
he says, I mean, does it have like legitimate basis in?
I was going to say it sounds like pseudoscience.
Yeah,
yeah. I think those things are a combination of things. Yeah. Where
then it's like pretty dangerous to just be like, yeah, here's Bill Clinton doing that.
No, but I think in a lot of those moments, it's very real.
Right.
But it's all suggestive. It's all just human behavior. It's psychology. It's
right.
It's obviously, you know, there's always different bases for what's right and what's wrong. But there's just certain things that you realize humans will do, whether they're aware of it or not. And then sometimes in the show, they are filming someone and they zoom in very close, or they like watch it in slow motion, or the way their mouth changes. And it's never 100%, but I think it's very indicative.
Right.
And often once you ask the right questions, you can dig the person out of the hole that they think they can be hiding behind.
Right.
So something might be more revealing, and then they might get more aggressive, and then they'll confess.
Right.
Wild.
So he sort of knows how to do it. But good old Tim Roth, who I only know from Reservoir Dogs.
Oh, and the Hulk.
Which Hulk?
With Eric. No, not Eric Edward Banner. Norton. It was Edward Norton's.
Yeah.
When Edward they started Norton's Marvel, it was Iron Man and Hulk.
Yeah. So Edward Norton was destined to be Hulk.
Yes.
But he only lasted one movie.
Yes.
And then it went to
Hulk. Oh, then they brought back Eric Roth in She-Hulk.
Yes.
Yeah.
They did.
Let's not talk about that series.
But yeah, lekker dudes. I need a show like Lie to Me.
Nice.
So it's very similar to Tracker, which I spoke about the other day, which is also on Disney Plus.
Yes. Okay.
Is that like sometimes you just want like, you know, it's a happy ending. You know, they're going to get the guy.
Yes.
As opposed to some like convoluted, dark, haunting TV show that could go in any direction.
Yeah. Speaking of which, I finished Baby Reindeer. Well, I bitched it in one night. Straight up.
Okay.
I was like, I'm not going to stop watching this shit.
Okay.
And it's really that good.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's stunning.
Any more thoughts on it after our chat last week?
No, I think it does a lot of work to reveal that kind of psychopathy to you.
Yes.
And it's kind of terrifying.
Right.
And now I saw Piers Morgan interviewed her.
Yeah. The real woman, yeah. Did you watch the interview?
No, I kind of want to distance myself from it a bit because I'm just like, this woman is a character, hey?
I think you can just appreciate the show for the show.
Yes.
Exactly. There's a lot for you to unpack.
And that's what that creator was trying to get at. Like, guys, like, please don't unpack everything. Like, yeah, it's a exactly. show. It's a, there are these fictional elements. Mm.
Exactly.
And you have to be allowed to take inspiration and make it more dramatic, you know?
Absolutely.
And we were just talking the other day that this guy, you know, that famously the person who acts in the show, this happened to him very largely in real life. And it was first a theater production, which he must have performed many times.
Right.
And then he's since written it as a TV show, which is now this big Netflix show. Where he acts in it.
Yeah.
Okay. This is what's so unique about it. It's not that other people are acting what happened in a true story. He's acting his own true story to some degree. But you can imagine, think about every funny dinner party you've ever told. Every time you tell it, you tweak it a bit.
Yes.
You change it. You make it more dramatic. So, especially if he's performed it live. So, whatever started, by the time they've now made this TV show, it's far more embellished.
Absolutely.
And so there has to be that license to be more creative.
You have to make it more
it.
Dramatic. That's the thing with adaptation. But the thing that really amazed me was when you hear someone say, oh, it starts off with him going to say, hi, I'm being stalked. And the person says, how long has this been happening? And he says, 6 months. And he's like, why haven't you reported it sooner? And you think to yourself, if you're being stalked, you go report it, right?
Yes.
What are the reasons why people don't report abuse? Why don't they report things like stalking? Mm. And it gets into that well. And it makes it convincing and understandable and empathetic.
As to why it's he never reported
it. Yeah, in terms of, or like why she misunderstands what he says.
Yeah.
Right. And takes it as flirting, or he was just joking. And it's those small little nuances that they're aware of. It's good writing. Mm. It is incredible writing.
Cool. Yeah.
Because the stakes are higher because this woman is trying to sue Netflix.
Yes. Yeah.
Which is what has raised these conversations and the stakes of this conversation as to what you should be able to say and not say.
Yes.
Yes.
And I think there's very interesting legalese about how one makes this kind of show.
Mm. Absolutely.
If you have said it's inspired, well,
inspired by reality.
Well, if you say this is a true story, is very different to inspired by a true story.
Mm. Yes.
And I think there's all these legalese that you should or shouldn't have in your show.
Yes.
You know, the most fictional shows, deep within the credits, right at the end, says this is an act of fiction.
Yes.
Any coincidences are
incidental.
Yeah. So it's very interesting that that all of a sudden this can become a legal battle.
Right.
Especially when it becomes so famous.
It seems like she's very much getting off on the fame of it.
Yeah.
You see, this is why you shouldn't get into it, because I'm seeing it like making complete assumptions about her and being like,
interesting,
you know.
Yeah.
So I don't want to do that.
Let's talk about who is going to come and visit us later this week.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Just to perhaps end off on that, unless there's anything else that guys want to chat about.
No,
I don't think so.
I am going to go in a few weeks' time with my whole family to watch Mamma Mia.
Oh.
Which is in Monte Cassino, and it's the big sort of production of the month, the few months. And our good friend Karuna is in it.
Yes.
And so Cole has reached out to her, and she is going to pop in.
Cool.
I'm so excited.
And that is going to be this coming Thursday.
Yeah, Karuna is a legend.
She's incredible.
She's so great.
And I've taken great joy in coming to watch Cole perform where often she's been performing on stage with him. And she's an amazing performer. So she's a actor, singer, dancer. I know she's taught a lot.
Yes.
But she's been in a lot of productions. And this is now sort of arguably one of the biggest things she's done, which is like the lead in Mamma Mia at the Teatro, which is lovely. So I'm looking forward to having her come and visit us. So that's going to be the guest chat, which will be on Thursdays. And this coming Thursday, in the week that this episode's coming out, we're going to have Karuna. What's her full name?
Karuna Lint Deva.
Karuna Lint Deva. Deva?
Deva.
Deva.
I discovered this while we were recording her. I was like, she said her dad's surname, and I was like, fuck. I've known you for 8 years, and now I've been pronouncing your name wrong.
Okay.
Surname. Well,
it's nice to learn it properly.
It's the worst.
Magic, guys.
Yeah.
Thanks for a lovely day. Mm. Nice to have you back.
Yeah, wonderful.
G-Force.
Right? Yeah.
Let's get to it. What do we have to do?
Now we got to go home, Cole. It's the end of the day.
Is it the end of the day?
Now it's the end of the day.
We like had a whole chat. We just spoke the whole day, dude.
The whole day.
That was a good chat. Yeah. Yo, one gets lost, eh?
our home base is thevideostore.co.za. This is our Clerks chat where we talk specifically about what we're watching on streaming platforms and out in cinemas. But as we said, there is a second episode every week which comes out on the Thursday, which is when an interesting guest will pop in to rent something. So look out for that this coming Thursday. But all the links to all the social media and previous episodes is at thevideostore.co.za. All right. Cheers, guys.
Bye-bye.
TTFN.